Without trust, society stagnates.
Economies decline.
And businesses fail.
My Security Media believes through security,
trust between individuals,
organisations,
and government can be maintained. Welcome to the
Cybersecurity
Weekly Podcast.
Welcome to My Security Media's Cybersecurity Weekly Podcast. I'm joined by Ian Yip, the Chief Technology Officer for the Asia Pacific for McAfee. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're here in Singapore. At least it's nice to be in some warm weather at this time of the year out of Australia. And we are here. We've just had the Cyber Risk Meetup last night. And many thanks to McAfee for sponsoring that. It was our inaugural event.
Yeah, happy to do it.
So there was about 65 people in the room. You were part of a panel session. And the panel initially focused on the new legislation here in Singapore, the Cybersecurity Act. So let's introduce the audience to the Cybersecurity Act, and it tends to be focused on critical infrastructure and places new onus on critical infrastructure to do risk assessments and the like. There's also a licensing regime for practitioners. What's your take on the legislation and the situation here in Singapore, I suppose?
I think it's a good start. It puts Singapore ahead of a lot of the other countries in the region, and it sets a good set of baselines for companies to be able to follow. And in the past, Singapore's had legislation around personal information and criminalizing cyber acts of, you know, the digital part of the criminal activity. But it hasn't really given the detail around what companies should be doing to protect Singapore and themselves. So this is something that's probably been needed for a little bit of time, particularly given where Singapore sits and where it sits in global standing for financial services and all the things that it does. And what it does is it lays out a set of standards that organizations that the Cybersecurity Commissioner of Singapore deems to be critical or to be holding critical information infrastructure to be able to do things like detect and respond to threats within a certain period, to mandate that they have to cooperate with the government in investigations. They're also held to being made to do risk assessments annually and audits at least once every 2 years and a whole bunch of other things. In terms of licensing service providers, I think at the moment they're limiting it to people who do penetration testing type assessments and also manage security services. I think that sets, and there's been a bit of a debate over whether that should be there, but it does set a bar for people providing those types of services to be able to ensure that they are of sufficient quality when they're providing those services to critical infrastructure organizations.
So there's a sort of insight into those providers that they have to meet certain standards, certain certifications and the like. I mean, anyone who knows me will know that I tend to advocate for licensing reform in Australia. What's your take on the requirements of this legislation and whether, you know, or do you think other countries like Australia will start to look at this and go, why haven't we done it? Should we do it? What's your take on? Do you think somewhere like Australia should start to implement these requirements, legislative requirements?
I think the debate around whether they should license service providers was really around there's a skills shortage. It's difficult to get enough people to do it. Do you really want to force people to jump through more hoops and climb a couple of steps? So I get that debate. And I suspect if we talk about it in Australia and some other parts of the region, that's going to be part of the conversation.
But that's also the other side of that is because there is a skill shortage, people just suddenly say, hey, I'm a cybersecurity expert. I don't have any training or I don't have any certifications and there's no probity into who I am. Even criminal history checks for a start. That take on that.
And that's exactly the other side of the argument, which I also agree with, which because there are some people jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak, because anything that's hot, like cybersecurity, like blockchain, like machine learning and so on, people suddenly go, well, there's money there to be made. I am an expert. Exactly that's the way you've said it. So I think there is some credence in looking at specific parts of service providers for cybersecurity to meet certain standards. I don't know if it would be a good idea to put a blanket statement to say all service providers doing anything at all in cybersecurity need to be certified, because that introduces a whole bunch of administration overhead and that governments probably don't want. And I think that's why Singapore's taken the approach to say, like, let's focus specifically on two areas and let's start there and see how we go. And I think countries like Australia should at least explore that possibility at some point, and whether we go with it or not, I take it.
I still think it's a siloed approach, though, in terms of, because Singapore also has sort of general security frameworks around, and you know, who can be a security guard and security consultants. Now they've siloed cybersecurity.
Mm.
So just it makes it difficult, I think, for the industry. Security is a segmented industry as it is, but to legislate it. But the legislation came in February, I understand. So we'll monitor this. I take it there hasn't been any breaches that you're aware of, that anyone hasn't been sort of taken...
None that have been reported, because the legislation does say if you're deemed to be critical infrastructure, you have to tell the government and report it and so on and tell the affected parties. So nothing's been reported since. So I guess we have to assume that in this realm of under the legislation, nothing's happened.
Okay, well, let's move on to the McAfee threat report. And then before we get into the threat report, maybe just go through the framework that McAfee's operating under. You have threat intel and antivirus. Most of the audience will not know McAfee as a brand anyway.
Yeah.
And then you've also got some products there as well. Mm. So just introduce us to McAfee as well and where you sit in your role as CTO.
Yeah, so as you've alluded to, most people know us for a specific thing around the endpoint and our core capability and strength for almost 30 years now, I think. On the endpoint, starting with antivirus and evolving to some of the more advanced threat detection type capability that we have. So we view that as our device protection capability, which will extend to anything that can be deemed as a device, particularly in the connected, ever-increasing connected world today. There's two other areas that we focus on in terms of our capability and our strategy. The second one is security operations. That's really about optimizing the efficiencies and reducing the amount of manual work that security analysts and security teams have to do to be able to allow them to detect and respond to threats much more quickly. And machine learning and artificial intelligence and those types of technologies and play a huge part to how we evolve that capability for our customers and for our partners who use our solutions to provide service to their customers.
Well, I've seen the SIEM in operation, and it's I don't like the term, but the single pane of glass and all this type of stuff. Yeah. But there's machine learning in the background of that in terms of how a network is operating and what type of alerts the analysts should be looking out for.
There's machine learning in all aspects of what we do. So even on the device and the endpoint, there's machine learning and some of the more advanced capability in there, because signatures are a good baseline to work with, and it does reduce the overhead and processing time required. So that cuts out a lot of the processing. Sometimes people complain that software makes your machine slow down.
Yeah.
So signatures allow them to sort of stay lean and move fast. But some of the more advanced capabilities allow us to pick up the threats that signatures won't pick up. The same can be said for our security operations capability to be able to look for patterns that aren't statically configured. Yeah. So if you're talking about SIEM, that's what we see as a foundation of a security operations capability, but you've got additional things like data protection, you've got additional things like threat hunting, you've also got user behavior analytics to be able to do some of the analysis around, okay, what looks normal and what doesn't look normal. And as a security operations professional, I'm just going to go after the stuff that doesn't look normal.
Yeah.
And where the machine learning really plays a huge part in that is allowing people to focus in on the handful of things that really matter rather than taking hours and hours and hours to trawl through the reams of data that a lot of teams have to struggle with.
It's almost getting to that point, isn't it, where just getting that baseline normal is what security is focusing on at the moment, particularly with that machine learning and the analytics there.
Yeah, and then the extension to that has all got to do with integration. So we're not going to come out and say you should have everything McAfee, because we believe that there's an ecosystem of solution providers that provide value to an organization. And generally, most organizations we work with have multiple products and technologies from different vendors. So we believe in allowing people to integrate with our capability and for us to integrate with theirs, and things like share threat intelligence between the solutions.
Yeah.
On things like our DXL platform, which allows for that sharing and the integration and automation orchestration of the capability to allow people to our teams to be a lot more agile in what they do.
Right.
So that's the SecOps part. The third focus area for us is cloud security. we acquired Sky High Networks, which is the leader in cloud access security brokers. We announced it late last year. We closed the acquisition early this year.
Right.
So that allows us, on top of the cloud security capability we already had in infrastructure as a service and platform as a service, it really increases our capability to also cover software as a service, to cover things like shadow IT, access controls, contextual decisions to be made based on risk and data. Because it gives us a lot of data capability to be able to say, okay, well, you're holding data in Dropbox. What do you want to do about it? What policies look like? So, I mean, we call ourselves the device to cloud cybersecurity company.
Right.
From a data standpoint, for example, it basically means if you're looking at a data protection strategy and capability to be able to protect yourselves, then we give you that, you know, device through to cloud, including SaaS.
Would you say your customers took you to the cloud, or you just realized that that was just something you needed to add on, I suppose?
I think it's
to
both
scale. Right? Yeah.
Our customers have been obviously moving towards cloud for a long time. And even before the Sky High acquisition, we had the ability to give people visibility in cloud, particularly in things like infrastructure as a service and platform as a service type environments. And also the ability to give people insights into workloads. What Sky High gives us is the additional ability to deal with applications and the things that your business people have to do and to get on with their daily jobs. And I think the mindset for cloud has much more to do with a frictionless type of behavior or enablement of people to do things, but do it safely rather than just
closing. And also do it from anywhere, I imagine, as well.
So that aspect is really important for a lot of our customers and businesses. And so they've been driving us towards that kind of way of thinking for a long time. And at the same time, we, from a strategic standpoint, have seen that need. And we've just, I guess, pivoted our strategy accordingly over the years.
Right. Well, let's see what we're up against with the McAfee Labs Threats Report for June 2018. Mm-hmm. Front cover, they outline or highlight three key campaigns. So one's the Gold Dragon, expands the reach of Olympics attacks. Then there's Lazarus, rises again, targeting cryptocurrency users. And then advanced data stealing implants, Ghost Secret and Bankshot have global reach and implications. Maybe just highlight, I'll just touch on in those three. So Golden Dragon sort of highlights a particular country.
Yes.
Lazarus is known to be associated with a particular country. Mm-hmm. And the last one in terms of advanced data stealing. So Golden Dragon would be Chinese orientated.
Well, I mean, that attack happened during the Winter Olympics, right?
Right, yeah.
So without talking about specific countries, that was targeting officials and specific teams during the Winter Olympics to try and get into that infrastructure. Obviously, the Winter Olympics happened in Asia.
Yeah.
So there was risk to the infrastructure of the country and everything around the Olympics. Obviously, it's a big, high-profile event, and if you're a criminal or someone who wants to cause some disruption, you target a high-profile event.
So and Gold Dragon has been around for a while, targeting Southeast Asian nations from memory as well. And Lazarus, North Korean-orientated apparently, yeah?
The attacks tend to originate from that part of the world. So a lot of the campaigns and the attacks that we track, Lazarus is one of the groups that tends to pop up and seem to be doing nefarious things.
Yeah, and again, I think we've got some material on our channels with Lazarus for some time. And the data stealing implants, Ghost Secret and Bankshot, obviously looking for credentials or any other data that they can seep out.
Yep.
Do you know much about that one in terms of those particular campaigns?
So that's an ongoing campaign. It started off, I think, with a whole bunch of financial institutions in Turkey.
Right.
And then that campaign is a little bit more sophisticated because it uses variants of something that we've seen in the past, affiliated with things like the Sony hack, but not the exact same malware variant. There are multiple things that are designed to sit there stealthily and just figure out, meaning they're hard to detect.
Yeah.
And then just look to exfiltrate data. Once it's discovered what's going on in the environment, that may be of use to the group that's being attacked. As you alluded to, it's all about getting the right kind of data in specific areas that it's been sort of sitting in.
and not to be detected. You know, I think that's the scary thing is the old adage of if you can't remember the in terms of if you haven't been hacked, or it's those two types of companies, those that have been hacked and those that don't yet know that they've been hacked. So
exactly.
That's a good one. The Lazarus one, in terms of the cryptocurrency, there's a lot of noise around the cryptocurrency hacks at the moment. So again, what are some of the trends that you're seeing in that space?
Yeah, so obviously cryptocurrency exchanges are a big target. If you think about the cryptocurrency market in general, and you look at startups, I mean, to me, the scariest thing is a lot of these cryptocurrency startups are exactly that. They're startups.
Yeah.
Now, if you've been in security for a little while and you know where the weak points tend to be, it's in some of the smaller companies that maybe security is a consideration, but it's not a focus. And when you overlay something like cryptocurrency exchange or cryptocurrency business on top of that, if you're not thinking security first, then you've left a huge door open for people to attack you, especially when one of the main goals, arguably the goal of cyber criminals, is to get after anything that they can monetize.
Yeah.
So given cryptocurrencies are allegedly anonymous, depending on which cryptocurrency you're looking at, and if you're going after a startup with, or a smaller company with presumably not as good security as, say, a bank, it's a lot less of a bar to try and jump over if you're trying to attack them than going after a large bank.
Which and they're going after the exchanges, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that the blockchain isn't secure. The blockchain infrastructure in itself serves a purpose.
Yeah.
The thing people need to be aware of, especially when you're talking about cryptocurrencies and distributed ledgers like blockchain, is that it is an ecosystem. And if you talk about security as a holistic practice, the blockchain alone being so-called secure doesn't imply that everything else around the blockchain is secure. And it's something people very often forget.
Yep. And even the data that sits inside that, there's obviously those sort of packages that you just don't know. What vulnerabilities are sitting there?
Yeah, because for example, if you take something like Ethereum, right?
Yep.
There's things like smart contracts, which is effectively code sitting on the Ethereum blockchain. Sure, everything can. The blockchain assures you integrity of data. So all you can know is that once somebody's put it on there, nobody's changed it.
That's right.
But what were the processes leading up to somebody putting it on there? So if you're putting a smart contract onto the Ethereum blockchain, if I'm an attacker, I want to put my code onto the Ethereum blockchain because everyone's just going to assume that it's secure.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be what everyone's saying, but it's not. So the attacker might put some malicious smart contract type code in that package, put it in the blockchain, and then when certain parameters are hit, that contract executes and does what the malicious attacker wants. Then, and if you're none the wiser because you're just assuming it's secure, you've got a big problem, right? So these are things people don't necessarily think about.
Well, I think this is where, particularly say the smart contracts, the more complex they are, the more that they're trying to do, the more vulnerability that will be inherently built into them, particularly in that code.
Exactly.
There is a McAfee blockchain report. We will put a link on for the podcast listeners. Maybe just what are some of the bigger numbers? You were rattling off some numbers last night, Ian, and I misquoted you too on my Twitter for 51 billion alerts every day, queries, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, so some of the trends. So we have one of the world's largest global threat intelligence bases, because we have all this software sitting in a lot of environments, whether it be on devices or network or in the cloud, which means we get a lot of this telemetry.
Yeah.
So we get on the average 51 billion queries from all these systems to our global threat intelligence database daily.
Right.
So to give you some context, Twitter gets about 500 million tweets per day. So it's a huge amount of queries we're getting. And the queries are effectively a system going, does this look bad or what's good? Can you tell me whether this is bad, right? So, and on the average, we get five threat sort of queries. Or we register five new threats every second.
Right.
As a part of doing that. In terms of trends, malware is up about 37% year on year.
Yeah.
Mobile malware is up 42% year on year, particularly here in Asia Pacific, because a lot of our region is mobile native, meaning they don't necessarily have laptops or desktops, but they have mobile devices.
Yeah.
So if you're an attacker and you're attacking our part of the region, you want to go after the mobile devices. Ransomware is something we've heard a lot about. It's obviously a subset of malware in general, but it's up 62% year over year. But the big one, given we're talking about cryptocurrencies, is coin mining, which is, as you were referencing earlier, if you're an attacker, you don't want to be found out, if at all possible.
Yeah.
Now, the stealthiest way to do it is to put coin mining software in somebody else's machine, use their compute power, and mine yourself some cryptocurrency without having to pay for it. Year on year, that's
almost up. Like stealing electricity. Yeah,
pretty steering much. Power, and nobody knows, right? Yep. Exactly. You just plug into your neighbor's PowerPoint, go charge up your car, your electric car. That's up just over 2,000% year on year, right? So there's a huge uptick in that kind of malware.
So we're not going backwards. That's what the threat report. That's why they're quarterlies now, isn't it?
That's right.
Okay. Well, look, again, we'll put the threat report link out there, and it's worth a read. It gets colourful at the end with lots of graphs, but as Ian alluded to, they're all going up. And finally, Ian, we'll touch on, you've been doing some work. There's a McAfee white paper coming out eventually, so I suppose it's one to watch. But just on the C-level agendas and communicating with the C-suite of enterprise, it's starting to get there slowly, I think, in Australia with executives and the Australian Institute of Company Directors. I get the journal and, most issues, they are touching on cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. But, again, you put most directors in the category of general consumers who have a low security awareness. What's some of the outtakes, or do you think will be the highlights of a C-level white paper out of McAfee?
Yeah, so this comes out of some work that we did with a bunch of our C-level customers late last year, actually. And we worked through a bunch of questions with them, effectively just to gauge where they were at with their cybersecurity programs and the perception that the other C-levels in their businesses had on cybersecurity, and also board members. And as you've kind of referenced, awareness is up, but awareness is different to understanding, right? So I think the awareness is up there. There's a lot of board members and C-levels who go, okay, I get there's a cyber problem.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
And the challenge for a lot of CISOs, CIOs, and security professionals is trying to explain what this means. And this bit of work that we did was really about trying to understand how we align our language. And it's really about simplifying the way you communicate what really matters and getting to the heart of what, using the language of the C-suite effectively, right?
Yep.
Which is effectively risk, finance, impact.
Yep.
Things that a lot of operational technology security people aren't used to talking in. And the second part is really a culture of security top-down. We've talked about this for a long time. And one of the things we asked our room of C-level people is like, who should be accountable, not responsible, accountable for security? And by and large, all of them said the CEO, right? Now, but at the moment, a lot of them said the CEO also, of all the C-suite, cares the least about cybersecurity. So there's a bit of a disconnect there in terms of security culture. And I think for the board and C-suite to be able to really get behind cyber, the security culture needs to come top down. People like the CEO and the board have to stand up and be accountable for cybersecurity, but make other people responsible for aspects of it. But they're the ones with their neck on the chopping block.
Well, I think it's the term I've kind of been hearing a little bit more and more, and is baking it in. And I think you've got to bake it into your culture. The CEO needs to be, because often CEOs are tasked with taking risk in terms of driving the enterprise or the business or whatever the business is in. But you've got to still do it relatively safely.
Mm-hmm.
And most businesses now are technology-related businesses or they're touched or, they have technology baked in.
Yep.
And we are still arguing to have security baked in as well. But it's really, particularly in Asia-Pacific, it's a high-risk region.
Yep.
And if you're operating in this region and you're a responsible and sort of a accountable CEO, you're going to be more than cybersecurity aware. You're going to be a cybersecurity practitioner almost, yeah?
Yeah, well, and I think the main takeaway here is as a security professional, you need to understand what language you need to speak to make the culture better and make the CEOs accountable and the board members understand better.
Yeah.
And it really is, like you said, risk, right? They understand enterprise risk. And that's the way to make them care. If you can articulate it in those terms, enterprise risk, financial impact, and what it really means if something bad happens to the business in those terms, that makes a more lasting impression to them. And one other aspect we also looked at is, okay, if you look at metrics, so metrics are very important, right? Because there's a lot of metrics. And some of me and our team in McAfee actually sat down and started to list out all the security operations metrics you could potentially measure. We got to about 100 and we stopped because we were saying this is getting ridiculous, right? And there's some confusion around even how you track security operational metrics. And when we asked things around, okay, what metrics do you think are important to the C-suite and the board? Most of the same things I'm talking about, risk appetite, maturity, and financial impact, those all came out top. Now, we sort of weren't sure from an operational standpoint whether those things would be more or less important than things like dwell time and the number of threats we found and how compliant we are, all those things, and then our patching cadence, which is much more technical. So the interesting takeaway from that part around metrics for security operations and technology professionals is those CISOs and CIOs in rooms, the room that we had, actually said, look, risk and impact metrics are just as important as those security operational technology metrics that we're so used to tracking. And if you miss any of that, you're kind of crippling yourself to not be able to report properly for security operational needs. And also, you're making it much more difficult for you to communicate the importance of cyber risk and cybersecurity to your C-suite and your board. And it ultimately helps with the alignment. And I think the key thing is make sure you're able to align all your metrics so that if one moves, you can sort of cascade it through to, okay, what does it mean for
overall impact on the risk? Yeah. And it's also feeding that cybersecurity risk into the enterprise risk in terms of, say, risk register and what that appetite is for the organisation as well. It's a very interesting and complex body of work. So that's going to come out, I believe. You kind of did mention, I don't want to put a time frame on it, but around September. But stay tuned, and eventually we'll put that link on this podcast as well. Now, in closing, again, we mentioned we were here for the Cyber Risk Meetup. Again, thanks to McAfee for supporting that event, and thanks for your time too, Ian, and your guidance on the panel last night. A look out, that's the next one's in Sydney on the 18th of July, and I think Shemaine is also working on an event in Brisbane later on in the year. I believe could be August. So that's the cyberriskmeetup.com, and also a big thanks to Ian Yip for joining us on the Cybersecurity Weekly podcast.
Pleasure.
Thanks
for having me.
Cheers, mate.